Have you ever loved someone more than life itself? I had the great good fortune to love, not once, but twice in this life. And I had the great misfortune to love them both at the same time. Once the world knew my name, they fought to buy my work, the rich, the royalty. I painted them all. I made myself the living test. And you were no one if not painted by Lampiga. How the dandies fought for my commissions, attended exhibitions, vied to buy anything my brushes ever touched. But the real art was how to survive. How did I wind up here?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, Brain Teasers for Broadway Geniuses, is now available wherever finer books are sold. Peter also has columns at Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of castalbumreviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hello. So this morning, I was scrolling through Facebook, and Jason Robert Brown has this post on Facebook that I think it's public to everybody. I'm pretty sure it's public. I forgot to check that. But Jason is in Tokyo right now because a producer has mounted honeymoon in Vegas in Tokyo and invited Jason to come see the production. And Jason starts the post off by talking about the development of the Hal Prince show that they did in Tokyo. What's it, Prince on Broadway? Or right. what was the name of that? Yeah. And Peter, you and I will appreciate this. Jason talks that he has found the best ice cream on earth there. And he talks about his love and affinity for ice cream, which is just another way that Jason Robert Brown and I align.
I'll be right over. Then, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm just reading this post about the ice cream. I was like, that's the reason alone to go to Tokyo. And I had been planning a trip to Tokyo next year. So this is going to make it to the top of my list now. Mm-hmm. So Jason talks about how he discovered this ice cream when they did the Prince show in Tokyo. And then he transitions into saying why he's there now for his honeymoon in Vegas. And he talks about the differences in Tokyo audiences. And Peter, you've seen shows in Tokyo before?
Three, but two would not be of any real interest to American audiences. But yes, I saw The King and I there.
And, really? Okay.
Yeah. Which was kind of interesting because obviously there's a profound difference between Japanese people and Thai people. But to my Occidental eyes, I didn't really see that. So Anna and Louis were Eurasian. And so they passed as people who were not either Japanese or Thai. And so because I know The King and I so well, I really got lulled into thinking that I was seeing an English language production until Sir Edward Ramsey came in the second act looking like Sessie Hayakawa. And then I realized, yes, I'm in Japan. What was really interesting was that the words, "Shall we dance?" were sung the first time that those words come up in the song. Everything else was in Japanese. I have no idea why those lines were sung in English. I don't know if it was purposeful. I don't know if it was an accident. I just don't know. But yes, I did see it. It was very nice. It was a production that was equivalent to Broadway. It was neither more opulent nor less opulent than you would the famous 1977 revival that Yul Brynner did. So it was quite an experience, and I was very glad I went.
Jason talks about how some of the references in Honeymoon in Vegas don't translate to the audiences there, and they've done a little bit of rewriting to make them more general Americanized so that the audiences understand. Jason also talks about how when a song plays in the show, the audience claps along. And that it's just so foreign to him, to his ears, to see this and hear this. And he says in parentheses, "Thank God they clap on two and four." So that's really wonderful.
Yeah, that didn't happen with The King and I, perhaps because it's more of a serious show. I don't know, but it certainly didn't happen there.
Jason.
There's a lot of talk about the fact that Japanese audiences don't applaud after every song, but that happened in The King and I. They did applaud. So apparently, now, by the way, I'm going back to, I think, 1987, maybe, when I saw the show there. So it's very possible, we're dealing with a completely different generation of
Sure,
theater growers.
always.
Just as I went to a Japanese baseball game, and it really struck me as a triple-A level type of teams playing. And now, of course, so many Japanese players come over and play Major League Baseball. So there's obviously been profound improvement over the years.
Yeah, the highest paid player in baseball right now is Japanese. So, yeah, it's he talked about the audience as well, as well as the showtime that shows start at 6 p.m. There because the audiences are 90% female, that men don't go to see shows, and that the women are expected to be home for their families, so that's why they have an early curtain time. So it's still a bit trapped in tradition and old ways, but interesting about that. And there is a boy band star in the Tony Danza role, and he said, and the run is basically sold out for Honeymoon in Vegas. So it's great, and we'll be talking a little bit about boy bands a little later on this morning. So anyway, I'll put the link in the show notes to Jason's post on Facebook. I think it's public, and you should be able to check it out. But it was fascinating. It was a really, really interesting read this morning. So let's get on to our reviews. It's that crunch time in the season when we have a million openings, and one of the openings that happened this week was Suffs. So Peter, you got a chance to see Suffs. First of all, did you see it downtown at the Public?
Oh, a lot of changes, a lot of new songs, and it's terrific. The only thing I don't like, the one and only thing I don't like about Suffs is the way that President Woodrow Wilson is depicted. And this brings me to 1776, because in 1776, John Dickinson, had he been written by an inferior writer, which Peter Stone was not, would have been fat and lisping and effeminate and silly. And instead, he has lines such as, "Oh, sure, Mr. Adams, we're going to give up England and the Magna Carta and the Plantagenets and Hastings and Strongbow." And you say, "Yeah, he's right." Better when he says, "Oh, sure, Mr. Adams, we have no money, we have no army, we have no European friends, and you think we're going to win." And you say, "Hey, he's right." So making a foe intelligent is a very important thing, I think. And as a result, that was the one thing in Suffs I didn't like, because Wilson is shown as a damn fool. Now, it is true that much of what he says is what he actually said way back when he really apparently, if this is to be believed, delayed the suffrage that women were denied the vote. He was in no hurry to give women the vote. But to make him a clown, a fool, silly, is just wrong. There's no reason to do that. We would be on the suffragist side anyway. So why gild the lily by making him so silly? I don't blame the actress. This is obviously with Shayna Taub. He was certainly the auteur of this piece, doing everything, including being on stage, playing Alice Paul, who was certainly a big mover and shaker in making these things happen. It's a very smart show otherwise, especially because at the beginning of the show, there she is fighting an established person who has been trying to get the suffrage movement going. Wonderfully played by Jen Colella, one of our favorites, needless to say. And so we have the old guard who's telling the young guard, as usually happens, it'll never work. You're doing all the wrong things. Here's the way to proceed. We have the answers. And what's really interesting at the end of the show, Alice Paul is now old and she's telling the young upstarts, no, 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 here's the way it's done. You can't do it your way. So I think that's very, very smart and very fair. The opening number, a new one, is terrific. It's so smart because it's essentially saying, would you deny your mother the vote? I mean, after all, look at all she's done for you and you won't let her vote. That's a very smart way. It really gets into the emotions when you start playing the mother card. It's very, very smart. It's been completely redesigned. The sets are, while not lavish, while not eye-popping, are certainly more interesting than the unit set that was at the public, which was simply like the set of stairs leading up to a courthouse. And so it's been improved in that way, too. But and here we go. The craft is fine. The rhymes rhyme, and most of the accents are right in the right place. So it's good songwriting, and I applaud her for that as well. By the way, not that we're going to see a revival of Funny Girl soon on Broadway, but Shayna Tabb would be an excellent Fanny Bryce, and I would love to see her have the chance to do it. But I do think she's going to be otherwise engaged for a long time, because I do believe this show will find an audience, and it certainly deserves to.
And she's writing other shows.
Yeah. Is she the one on Devil on Prada?
Yes. Yeah. And with Elton John.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that sounds familiar to me. Mm.
Lyrics by Shayna Taub.
Good for her.
Excellent. Speaking of great lyrics, I just heard a great lyric. We should save that for the future. Why gild the lily by making him so silly? All right. So that is Suffs over at the Music Box Theater. Michael and I are going to see it later on. Michael, you have it on the schedule soon or? Great.
I have seen it off Broadway. It's interesting that, you see, I don't tend to have that clear recall, but interesting that, Peter, that you say that there have been substantial changes.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just reading, I just now read the New York Times review of Hell's Kitchen, and according to that review, there have been substantial changes in that as well. I really give these people credit if that's true, because so often that doesn't happen.
You bet.
In my experience,
you bet. They stand still. They really feel that it's been misdiagnosed by the critics, and the next time they'll get it right.
Exactly.
We're fine. Oh, I've seen that so many times. Yeah.
I'm putting my cards on the table right here is that I saw Suffs downtown at the Public, and I thought it was good, and I thought it was long, and I thought it needed lots and lots of work and things like that. And when it came to Broadway so quickly, I thought they're not going to do the work here. So I actually did not schedule it, but then I didn't schedule it myself to see it on Broadway. And then the reviews came out and people were like 75% new songs and overhauled and new concept. And, you know, they did the work. So I was like, oh, I guess I better schedule this. So I scheduled myself to see it in the upcoming weeks. So that's Suffs for right now. We'll talk about it when Michael sees it, when I see it again. Last week, Peter talked about The Outsiders. Michael and I saw it this week. So, Michael, what did you think of The Outsiders?
Well, I'm going to guess that this is a property that if you first encountered it at a very young age and grew up with it, you're going to respond to it a lot better than someone like me who never encountered it in any form until old age. because it's... So, and many people, apparently many people did encounter it at a young age because I'm told it's still on the reading lists of high schools and maybe even junior high schools, as it has been pretty much since the book, the original book by S.E. Hinton came out in 1967. So I'm sure that all of those people have a great affection for it for that reason, and also for the film, which had all of those now stars and, you know, at the very beginnings of their career. I mean, the cast of that film is just amazing. But for me, it just seems so cliched and predictable, generally speaking. And also the very earnest tone of it, I don't think is well handled. Now I'm just judging from the musical, which I saw cold with no previous experience whatsoever of the book or the movie or anything else. So that was my opinion. By the way, S.E. Hinton was still very young. She was a teenager when she wrote this. And I was wondering, I didn't do the research. Do we think that maybe that she used those initials because in those days, maybe she thought she wouldn't be taken seriously if everyone knew she was a woman?
I don't know a fact, but I've inferred that.
Yeah, that's what J.K. Rowling did. J.K. Rowling used, instead of Joanne Rowling, she used J.K. Lots of folks do that to sort of distance themselves from something.
Right.
I would imagine that S.E. Hinton did that as well. S.E. Hinton is 75 years old now.
Yeah. Well, that's that's such a commentary, of course, on the time.
Yeah.
And so unfortunate that she felt that necessary, but it certainly didn't. Maybe it did help this. You know, I had heard it was only a title to me and I knew who wrote it, but I didn't mm-hmm. know actually until recently that she was a woman. So that's so interesting. And also interesting because I would say the story is so much mostly like 90% concerned with male characters. But she certainly seems to have had an affinity for them and just being able to write from that perspective. So I find all that very interesting, but that was my reaction to the story as seeing it, encountering it at this very, you know, late date and this late stage in my life. I thought the characters were interesting, but again, just kind of cliched and predictable, and the earnestness did bother me. I also thought it seemed to me that there were like three or four different endings. three or four different places where this story might have ended. There's the rumble at the end of Act One, which, I mean, that's not really an ending so much. And as we know, there's a rumble at the end of Act One of West Side Story. Then there's the rumble at the end of Act One. Then there's and I hope this is not a spoiler. None of these are spoilers. But again, this book has been around since 1967. And then there was the film and all that. The rumble at the end of Act One. Then there's the fire in the church. Then there's the death of one major character, Johnny Cade. And then the death of another character, Dally. So I kept thinking that we were at the end, and then all of this other stuff kept happening. And it also gets a little sledgehammery with all of this misery and all of these bad things happening over and over. The new musicals that I've seen so far on Broadway this season, generally speaking, and you have to be careful with generalizations, but I think that I would say that the music is far better than the lyrics. And I think that's a case here too. And I was going to say, I would never phrase it to say that it's easy to write great music, because I don't believe that. But I would say that it's harder to write really good lyrics than good music, because I think you have more latitude in writing music, and I think there's actually more specific craft involved in writing lyrics, especially for musical theater. Now, that's assuming that like me and Peter and others of us, that you feel it's necessary to have things like lyrics that rhyme, lyrics that scan properly without having the emphasis on the wrong syllables when the lyrics are being sung. So anyway, that was my general thought here, that the music really was much, much better than the lyrics. And I did like the music, but you know, when you try to separate them that way, that can be difficult. By the way, the music and lyrics are credited to Jamestown Revival, which consists of Jonathan Clay and Zach Chance. And then also thirdly credited is Justin Levine. The book here is by Adam Rapp with Justin Levine. So those are the credits there. I thought the very talented young cast with Brody Grant in the central role of Ponyboy Curtis and lots of other really talented people, Sky Lakota Lynch, Joshua Boone, Brent Comer, Jason Schmidt, Emma Pittman in the only significant female role of Cherry Valance, Daryl Tofa, Kevin William Paul, Dan Berry, Sarah Grace Mariani, Tilly Evans Kruger, Rennie Anthony McGee, and Kevin, Kevin William Paul. I happen to attend the show with someone who grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Although, of course, quite a few years after the events depicted here, which is supposed to take place in 1967. And, you know, I mentioned that trying to work black performers into a show like this specifically is especially more challenging because it's all about the socioeconomic positions of these young people. You have the haves and the have-nots. You have the socias and the greasers. And he said that when he grew up, that the black people were considered a separate class, and they would never. I don't think that greasers in real life included black people. I don't think they would have been identified as such, but that's the situation you have here. So whether or not you think that's an issue, Peter, I was, when you said last week that these names of these boys, Pony Boy and Soda Pop,
right,
were their real names. I was very shocked, and I couldn't understand why that would be. And I don't think there's a specific statement made to that effect in this show. But I asked my friend who grew up there and who also read the book and saw the movie, and he said that in either the book or the movie, there is a specific statement that those names were given to them by their parents. So I don't quite get that, and I think that would have been more believable if that we were supposed to think they were their nicknames, like those nicknames of the gangs and the gang members in West Side Story.
Yeah, Guitar is not that boy's name on the birth certificate, right? Yeah,
yeah. that's pretty much what I have to say. I'm told that in the book and maybe in the movie that Pony Boy, he's very much he's very bookish, I guess you would say, and he's supposed to have a poetic soul, even though he's, you know, he's in with these people who are pretty much almost a member of a gang. And I'm told that in the source material, he is into Gone with the Wind. But that has been cut here because that property also is considered so problematic by so many people. So that's my general reaction. I don't think that I think most of the performers do not credibly seem like they're young teenagers, but there's only so much we can expect from that in casting on Broadway, of course. And the audience reaction seemed to be very good overall. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of long-term prospects this show has.
So I saw it this week as well, and my take on it was that I loved it. Ah. And I really wasn't looking far into the material as far as what Michael had just what you just talked about or Peter last week. I sort of try not to compare things to, I try to let them to stand on their own. I really liked the music, but I think what really made this production for me was outstanding direction. I felt that it was really, really well directed insofar as telling the story and keeping things moving along. There was very often towards the end of a scene, they would move the action off to stage left or stage right or something like that. And the dark side of the stage would be set for the next scene. Mm. And they would just do a lighting change. And it would be like a seamless film type of cut there to the next scene. And it kept everything moving forward in the story. I felt that the Great Expectations song, I thought was very, very good. The voices are good. I see that there's a lot of Broadway debuts in main characters here, and it's going to keep Peter in the Theater World Awards very busy for this cast, at least, if not some of the other casts that are opening on Broadway right now. And the audience was crying at times around me and very much engaged. It was very, very full. So I think that right now they have something on their hands that just needs to be handed off to the marketing department. And whether it runs or not, I think is now up to marketing. They got, you know, okay reviews. They didn't get blowout over the top reviews, but they didn't get bad reviews either. And I think that they have something to work with, a very marketable and known product. And they do a stand-up job and the cast is outstanding. So I think that, you know, that this could be around for a number of years. I sort of put it in the, for me, it's in the realm of maybe like a Hadestown, something that, or a Moulin Rouge is better than Hadestown, because I thought Hadestown was much better. Moulin Rouge was good, and it was something that's marketable, and they can keep it running if they're smart and produce it well. And I think that the same thing can happen with The Outsiders. And I also thought to myself, wow, they could really do this at, you know, colleges and community level and regional theaters. This will be a big one as soon as the rights become available to those venues. So yes. I think that The Outsiders, you know, I think it'll be around for a while.
So I should ask, did you have a history with the property?
I read it in school and I saw the movie and I remembered some of the big points, but didn't remember a ton of the details. I have to add that my wife, Laura, was very negative. She hated the show.
Interesting.
But she was big on the movie. She loved the movie. She can recite the movie. She, you know, and she had a crush on every single movie, you know. Yeah. And she kept on saying about... who's the brother? I can't think of the brother's name.
Do you mean the character name or the actor?
Yeah, the character name.
The older brother,
the middle
soda,
brother.
Soda pop.
Soda pop spent like, you know, half the first act with no shirt on.
Yes.
And she was like, he's no Rob Lowe. You know, and I was like, oh, that was the Rob Lowe role. Okay. I was like, some of the, you know, folks in that show are in very good shape. The guy who played Dallas, I was like, holy moly, the guy who played Dallas, you know, he spends his life at the gym. So, yeah.
I think that was Soda Pop. Soda Pop is the one. Well, he's the one with the shirt.
Soda Pop spent with no shirt off, but Dallas, when Dallas does his second act song,
right. Oh yes, just, that's right. Just,
I was like, wow, it's legs and arms day for him at the gym every day. Well, you know.
Well, James, even though she loved Rob Lowe and all the others, she chose you.
Well, you know, people often, you know, choose Rob Lowe when they can't have me. That's right. So.
By the way, I'm told that the you mentioned Great Expectations. I'm told that that is a new reference for this musical. That particular book was not mentioned in the book.
Oh, interesting. I didn't remember Great Expectations, so that makes more sense. But I think Gone with the Wind is mentioned.
Yeah,
and I sort of remembered that. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's where that's where the change was made. Maybe Gone with the Wind was swapped out. For Great Expectations.
All right. So that's The Outsiders at the Jacobs. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Peter, you got over to the Schubert to see Hell's Kitchen, the Alicia Keys musical, which opened last night. So tell us what you thought about this.
Oh, what I loved about the show is that it has a great deal of heart. That's what I like best. The songs and the choreography certainly are quite fine, but the songs are secondhand to us. But nevertheless, they work very, very well. But the best part of the show is definitely the book, because indeed, here we have a situation where a young girl, Ali, nicely played by Malia Joy Moon, is certainly in a situation where she can go the wrong way. She meets a guy that she really, really pesters into having a relationship with her, and she doesn't make it clear that she's underage, and it really comes as a shock to him, and he's very upset when he finds out about it. She has a great deal of problems with her mother, who certainly wants to keep her on the straight and narrow. And like any teenager, really believes that, hey, I'm 17 years old now, therefore I know everything, I can do everything, I'm not a child anymore. And there are very few adults who believe that kids who are 17 certainly are not children anymore. So anyway, really, things could have gone really bad for her. Luckily, she wanders into the acting room in Manhattan Plaza where she's living, and she runs into Miss Liza Jane, Keisha Lewis, a terrific performance, certainly going to be remembered at awards time, who takes her under her wing and teaches her how to play piano and turns her into the person she becomes. So it's a wonderful story about how art changes people's lives and how it makes it better. And that's exactly what happens here. So very well performed. Also, Shoshana Bean, who I've known since she was a college student at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, plays the mother. And it would seem to be a thankless role, because she always has to come down hard on a kid. And, you know, you're grounded. Don't do this. Stay in. Eat this. You know, so on and so forth. She is pretty much redeemed by a second act song where she really gets to sing her lungs out and does it extraordinarily well. So a lot of applause for a lot of songs in this show, and certainly well deserved by a cast who knows how to deliver them. But most importantly, the fact that art changes people for the best, and that people can care about people they don't really know about when they meet them, and they really take a shine to them, and certainly become great friends. All that is quite nice. Now, it's very interesting, and this is where Michael comes in. Martin Platt, who's a Broadway producer and started the Alabama Shakespeare Festival in Montgomery, Alabama, which is quite a place, by the way, went on Facebook and talked about the fact that, you know, she makes Manhattan Plaza seem like this terrible hellhole, and it's not at all. So, Michael, here's maybe where you chime in and tell us, you've seen the show?
I saw it downtown, yes.
Okay. So did the stuff of Manhattan Plaza rub you the wrong way, the way it rubbed Martin?
Well, I'm not sure that they portray Manhattan Plaza as a hellhole so much as that Hell's Kitchen still was largely at that time. Did you feel like they were saying that Manhattan Plaza itself was a hellhole?
No, he does talk about the fact that the neighborhood. I don't know. I guess I was around at that time and was in that neighborhood now and then. Certainly had friends
But one thing, well, on that same note, another resident here, a friend of mine, we were talking recently because we'd both seen it. He saw it on Broadway and okay. I saw it off.
All right.
And he said that, I mean, it certainly it is not accurate in showing the makeup of the residency of Manhattan Plaza because it's very, very mixed. It's not just lower income people, and it's not just artists. There are also elderly from the neighborhood, and there were at that time there would have been a lot of AIDS sufferers, and so anyway, yeah. So it's not the idea that she. And I guess it's fine that she hangs out with other people of color, and certainly that makes sense. But it did not give an accurate picture of the diversity of the residency here. So I don't know how important that is. But I mean, I guess that's represented by the fact of the major character of Allie's mother, who is white and had been. Married to a black man, and so that's so she Allie is the product of that union.
All right, so that's Hell's Kitchen at the Schubert. Michael, you're going to see it on Broadway?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll come back and visit that again once you see it. Next up, the three of us got to see a production of Limpica at the Long Acre. So, Michael, why don't you get us started on Limpica?
Yeah, I hate to start because I really did not like the show very much at all.
So, Peter, do you want to start? I have the same problem Michael has.
Well, I was going to do it. I was going to start anyway. I was just going to say that I pointed out that I didn't like to, but
okay.
But I can.
All right.
I can.
Okay.
Yeah. This is based on the fascinating true story of Tamara de Limpica, who was a Polish Jewish painter who survived both the Russian Revolution, despite the fact that she was in St. Petersburg around the time that happened, and then later survived World War II, despite the fact that she was in Paris at the time that happened. And neither of those two places were good places to be in those periods, those incredible periods of history. This is another case where I guess I would say the music is better than the lyrics, but here that's not saying much because I thought both of them were very kind of second or third, maybe third rate, very superficial and melodramatic depiction of the events in this really fascinating life. There was as we've discussed before, there was a show years ago at the Armory, the Park Avenue Armory, called Tamara, which was not a musical. And the gimmick of that show at the time was really, maybe a unique gimmick, is that you followed the actors from one room to another. And you didn't necessarily, in fact, you didn't, you were unable to see all of the scenes, but you would piece together your own narrative from according to whichever actors you chose to follow. And so maybe it wasn't a complete story, but actually that was a good thing because there was so much in this woman's life that to attempt to tell all of it, I think, is maybe the major downfall of this show. And that's why it winds up seeming very melodramatic and schematic. Sometimes it almost seems campy because so much is happening at once. And I don't think it helped for me. It didn't help that a lot of, well, not a lot of this show, but some parts of it are extremely vulgar, especially the parts dealing with Tamara's romantic and sexual relationships and her lesbianism. So I really didn't like that. But as I said, the score, I think, was only very intermittently effective, marred again by false accents and false rhymes, really blunt storytelling, little nuance. There's a lot of projections in newsreels. Hitler turns up in newsreels a couple of times. And of course, that's going to have an effect. But they didn't really mix with the storytelling, which I thought was very superficial and sometimes inept. Peter mentioned before that he did not see Eden Espinosa in the title role, and I did. I really like Eden Espinosa, and I've liked her in the past, but I thought that this role was not well written enough for her to really embody it very well from a dramatic standpoint. I'm not, you know, one hopefully she would have been able to give a better dramatic performance if the actual writing had been better. But also I have to say, and it pains me to say this, the night I attended, she was doing a tremendous amount of flat singing. And my immediate thought was she is immediately going to pull back from doing 8 performances a week as soon as she is allowed to do so. I can't believe they signed her for 8 a week from the beginning. I guess they do that because it helps, theoretically helps with Tony nominations. But it's a huge, huge role. I would say it is really right up there with Evita. This show has been compared to Evita in some ways. And I think in terms of the size and difficulty of the title role, I think it absolutely is. So that was my first reaction. She's not going to be able to continue doing this 8 times a week. And lo and behold, shortly after the opening, she started to miss. I knew she missed at least one performance, but apparently it was more than that. I'm not sure, Peter, if you know how many.
I don't, but yeah. I can certainly attest to 2.
Yeah, at least 2. I thought, although I have loved Rachel Chavkin's work in the past, I thought the direction here was rather poor in terms of the general. Not so much in terms of the general movement and blocking of the show, but I thought the direction of the supporting roles in particular were I thought that there was a lot of very, very broad characterizations, and in particular I was very put off by the what I thought was the overacting of the role of Marinetti by George Aboud. So I don't know how much of that was his own conception of the role and how much of it was Rachel Chavkin, but I wish she had kind of sat on him about that. Lots and lots and lots of choreography by Raja Feather Kelly. Maybe too much, I thought. As far as the rest of the cast, I always appreciate hearing Andrew Szymanski's singing. I really liked hearing him again in the role of Tadeusz Lempicki, who is Tamara's husband. And Beth Level is in an odd role of a sort of peripheral role of a baroness, which wasn't much of a role either in terms of the writing, but she still has all of her presence that we've seen in so many other shows. And I thought she managed to retain her dignity and give a really wonderful performance. And I also like Natalie Joy Johnson, who managed to create an interesting and engaging character as Susie Salvador, who is the owner of a club, who becomes friendly with Tamara. So there were a lot of good elements in this show, but overall, I just thought it was quite a mess, and I really didn't like it very much at all.
Peter, what'd you think?
Well, last week I said, but I thought it was a mistake for the Outsiders to mention the words West Side. Because it reminded you of West Side Story. This show starts off very much like Sunday in the Park with George. You hear words like Lampica sitting down and saying words like harmony the words that you hear at the beginning of Sunday in the Park with George. And I thought, boy, if you're dealing with an artist, I don't think it's a good idea to compare yourself to Sunday in the Park with George, which does everything better than this show does. The best I can say for it is it really held my interest. I was very surprised that I was as engaged as I was. I was never bored, and I thought that the second act even held me more than the first act, and that's really quite rare, because there's even a wonderful book by Stephen Susskind called Second Act Trouble, which is a well-known cliche in the theater world, that so many shows start off well and then don't continue to be wonderful. But this one maintained my interest, so I have to say that is in its favor. I don't disagree with anything that Michael has said, but nevertheless, it did hold my interest. And yes, I did not see Eden Espinosa. I saw Marianne Torres, who at least went on twice this week, because I was supposed to go to the Wednesday matinee, and they said, you can't go. Eden is out. So I said, okay, I'll go Saturday night. And at 5 o'clock that on Saturday, the email came in saying she's out again. If you want to go, you can go, and if you want to wait, you can wait. But I just don't have any open dates left between now and the end of the season, so so I had to go. But Marianne Torres, you would never know that she was a standby. Never. I mean, boy, not just letter perfect, but I mean, in every conceivable way perfect. So it's hard for me to believe that Eden Espinosa would be any better. I do think that the cast is very, very strong. Amba Iman as Rafaela, the woman who catches Lampica's fancy and does wind up having an affair with her. And yes, Andrew Samosky, who's her husband, and somebody she really had to work hard to get out of jail when he was unfairly imprisoned. So that's part of the story as well. And that comes up later in no uncertain terms. The owner of the nightclub, as Michael mentioned, Susie, Natalie Joy Johnson, was of great interest to me, too. She had great style and great presence, so I liked her as well. I don't know. Maybe sometimes you just have those nights when you just go with it. You go with the flow, and that's what happened to me with this show. I know it's no masterpiece, and I'm very surprised that so much of the show waits until the end to show us her paintings. I understand that's really very dramatic to have all the paintings show up at the end, but most of the time you are looking at empty frames.
Yes.
And would it spoil some vast eternal plan if we could see the paintings as time goes on? I think it really would be very worthwhile, because the projections are quite large and immense throughout the show, and there's a lot of historical footage. Does seem to be historical footage that seemed overly familiar to me, but nevertheless, there it is. And but I don't know. It's so easy to make the comment about empty frames being a metaphor for the show itself. But anyway, so be it. But I don't know. It held my interest.
So in the interest of time, I'm not going to review this because Peter and Michael have said everything much better than I could have. So let's,
Peter, I do agree with you about that it becomes much more compelling as the second act goes on. And I would mention that, as I said to the friend with whom I attended, that I thought Beth Level's number at the end was a high point.
I should have mentioned her. She's always terrific, and she certainly does have a very dramatic number at the end. And after she finishes, she has a very nice moment with the characters the actor who plays her husband.
Yes.
It's a very tender moment. So that does work well.
All right. So that's Lampica at the Longacre. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So, Michael, you got over to Carnegie Hall to see the Master Voices production of The Grapes of Wrath. So tell us about this.
Well, The Grapes of Wrath is an opera based on the great book by John Steinbeck, and the opera is by Ricky Ian Gordon. And I first encountered it about 10 years ago this was not a full presentation of the opera, which is quite an epic work. I have a recording of it on CD, and it takes up 3 CDs. So when they did it 10 years ago at Carnegie Hall, when Master Voices was called the Collegiate Chorale, and now when they did it again this time, they do not present the whole thing. It's very large excerpts of it. And the concert was still 2 hours and 45 minutes with one intermission, even though it was not remotely the whole thing. But I would say, as I probably said last time, that if anything, what you have here is too much of a great thing, because I think it's a beautiful, very, very well written and compelling opera adaptation of that classic tragic story by Steinbeck. If it's just that there's so much of it that's so good, I almost feel like that. And again, I have never seen the entire thing. And to be honest, I haven't actually gone through the entire recording. I think it would benefit if there were maybe some more conversational passages in it and sung dialogue. What you have here is a lot of really, really strong, passionate music and played by a huge orchestra. And what's interesting also is that I would say that this story as originally written and for anyone who knows the film, the classic film, is very intimate. And that is true here too, but it's also given an epic sweep by the fact that Gordon did a magnificent job of working a chorus into the story. And you might think, well, how did he do that? He just managed to do it somehow, in the scenes in the camps where the Okies are staying while they're trying to get to California. And then once they do get to California, but also, I think the best part of this piece is the opening chorale, just magnificent choral writing in the opening chorale, which is titled "The Last Time There Was Rain." And it starts out with, a few soloists talking about the last time that there was rain in that area, in what became the Dust Bowl. And it starts out, with just wonderful reminiscences of the rain coming down and children's, splashing in the water and wonderful things like that. But then it stopped. And as anyone who knows the book or knows the actual history, what happened was that there was a drought in that part of the country. And partly because they had not done what they were supposed to do in terms of crop rotation before that, that was exacerbated by the drought, and everything turned to dust, and God knows how many lives were ruined and livelihoods were ruined because people could not grow crops anymore, and so they were all displaced, and they had to go try to find work elsewhere. So that is the tragic story here, and I do think that Ricky Ian Gordon did a beautiful job of making it into an opera. Whether it would have been more effective as a musical with dialogue scenes is debatable. We don't have a musical of this piece, so I can't say. And if we did have it, it wouldn't have been written by Ricky. But this is what we have here. The cast was magnificent. I would say mostly probably casting people that you wouldn't know unless you're into opera. Although we had two narrators here, J. Smith Cameron and Joe Morton, and they really, really added to the proceedings, and maybe gave a more effective, maybe this was a more effective presentation because of the existence of spoken narration rather than the performance being through sung. Kyle Oliver was really terrific in the central role of Tom Joad. And you might also know, you may have heard of a woman who used to be billed as Brianna Marie Parham. She has been in 5 Broadway shows, including Prince of Broadway. Now she is billed only as Brianna Marie. Not sure why she made that change, but she did. And she appeared in the small but really, really beautiful cameo role of May, who is a waitress in a diner where the Joads stop on their way to California. And at first she's very dismissive of them and kind of looking down on them as these Okies, you know, who have no money and are just why are all these people coming in here? But then she her humanity comes through and she winds up treating them very, very nicely. And that's a beautiful moment in the book and the film, and in this operatic version of the show, of the story. So I'm really glad I got to see it again. I think it's if you want to try to find that recording, the complete recording, I really think it's worthwhile, because Ricky and Gordon did such wonderful work, and very skillful work in making an opera of this great, great story. But I should say libretto by Michael Corey, whom we also know from Great Gardens and other shows that he wrote. And Ted Sperling was the magnificent conductor and director of this performance, which featured the master voices chorus, the very large master voices chorus, and the orchestra of St. Luke's.
So that's a master voice production of The Grapes of Wrath at Carnegie Hall. It was a one night only thing at April 17th. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So that wraps it up for today. Before we get on to our brain teaser and our musical moments, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it automatically downloads to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on Apple Podcasts. There's many ways to get us. Patreon, patreon.com/BroadwayRadio. Is one way that you can subscribe and get us earlier than everybody else, plus support all the Broadway Radio projects and different podcasts that we have. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's brain teaser?
Baby June was established to be 3'3". Dainty June was revealed to be 5'2". Someone who's mentioned in a song in a Rodgers and Hammerstein hit is between those two in height. Who? What musical? Well, in South Pacific, we're told that Honey Bun is only 60 inches high, which translates to 5 feet. Steve Bell was the first to answer, followed by Rob Johnston, Tony Janicki, Cheryl Hodges Selden, Paul Witte, Sean Logan, Juliet Green, Josh Israel, Mike Meany, Gregory Blazer, Arthur Robinson, not to be confused with David Robinson, who got it too, Jeff Hickman, J. Aubrey Jones, Nikki Juvan, Reed Loveland, Jack Leshner, Brigadude, and Deb Popple. So this wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be for people, needless to say.
We'll Even I got it. Even I got it.
Imagine. This week, the title of a Tony-winning musical's final song starts with a word. It's also the first word of a famous international chain. The second word of the chain's name is a word used to describe the type of song I'm talking about. What's the chain? What's the song? What's the musical?
Okay. If you have an answer for that, email us at trivia@BroadwayRadio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So, Michael, what do we have in this week's musical moments?
Well, even though we didn't collectively respond very well to Lempicka, I found a clip of Eden Espinosa singing Unseen from that show. a video clip. And so that is our opener and our closer. She sounds terrific in this clip. As I said, I really have enjoyed Eden in past shows. I hate to think, but it seems like this role is, as written, is really not possible to perform 8 times a week over and over again. And that's one of the flaws in the writing, I would say. I think that's a pretty significant flaw. So I wouldn't be surprised if this show does run. I wouldn't be surprised if an alternate is announced very soon. But whatever happens, we certainly wish Eden Espinosa the best. And in the meantime, please enjoy her performance of Unseen from Lempicka.
Okay, so on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I wind up here, forgotten worlds inside me, unseen. I tangled with a world you can't imagine, luxury and deprivation. Princes fought to light my cigarette, crawling up from nothing I created for myself, something that the world had never seen. I painted what a woman could be. Do you know who I am? An old woman who doesn't give a damn that history has passed her by. History's a bitch, but so am I. How did I wind up here? With a paintbrush. Today I will marry the only man for me. I will be a Lempicka.